The Christian faith is full of paradoxes, and I know that's not news to you, that God could be yet three, yet one, that Jesus would be both fully God and fully man, that God is sovereign over all things, and yet humans are responsible for their actions. All of those represent paradoxes, where there are two truths that seem to be irreconcilable with one another, but each of which seem to be undeniable, and you just have to hold that tension in place. But paradoxes, to be sure, are not confined to the transcendent realm. If you just type in paradox into Wikipedia, you will see a list of no fewer than probably 8 dozen paradoxes in philosophy and economics and in science and in interpersonal relationships. Just these ideas, and they all have names, interesting names, like the barber's paradox, or I don't know what that was either, something about hair. All of them are about paradoxes. I want to talk to you this morning about one paradox of human experience, and it's this. It's the paradox about being known by someone else. Here's the paradox. To be known is both terrifying and it's liberating. It is one of the more terrifying experiences known to humanity, and I know that because we all know that, because we all do a big, we all take great strides into putting forth a particular version of ourselves that we think will be acceptable, and we have an instinct to want to conceal everything that we think might be, make us, render us unacceptable in the eyes of others. We are terrified about being known fully. Maybe a little we like that, but not a lot. And yet, there is also the experience of being totally liberated when you know that you're known. For as many people that are terrified of being known about certain truths, there are just as many who believe that they didn't really start to live until they were known. And so that's the paradox. There's both great fear and great freedom in being known. This morning, we're going to conclude our series of praying the Psalms back to God by listening to a psalmist come to understand something about knowing and being known. And we're going to hear that paradox reflected in his words, the paradox of being both terrified and liberated in knowing that is known. And the way I'd like to set up our consideration of Psalm 139 is just to have you look at what will be our benediction this morning from that very famous passage in Paul's letter to the Corinthians, the end of his passage on love. He says in verse 12 of 1 Corinthians 13, "For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known." It's a tenet of our faith, brothers and sisters, that there will be a day when you shall see him as he is, and your knowledge of him will be as complete as his knowledge of you is already. Right now, at best, we see him through a glass darkly. What then? Until then, the psalmist is going to give us three things that we must do until we know as we are already known. And it's these three things: to seek God's peace, to sift your passions, and to submit to his probing. Seek his peace, sift your emotions, sift your passions, submit to his probing. Would you stand as we read Psalm 139? Psalm 139. "O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's high. I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. You saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there were none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O men of blood, depart from me. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God. Know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. See if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Each psalm has a setting. Some we are aware of, many we are not. This psalmist speaks of no particular historical referent that we could identify, but it does give us a sense of what he's facing. But you don't know that until about two-thirds of the way through. The first 18 verses, you almost think that he's out on a walk in a cherry orchard and he's just sort of, you know, loving and embracing and reveling in all the goodness that he knows that God loves him. And yet, if you listen very closely in verse 19, you know that he is not on a stroll. He's fighting for his life. And among those who don't simply revile him, it's among those who actually despise the God he loves. And he is passionately exercised against them, which is a bit of a euphemism, but I'll save that to the second point. Suffice it to say, he's in deep distress, as many of the psalmists are, as we've discovered. But it's in that distress that drives him to seek what would allow him to face his moment. It's what we all do. When we're threatened, we run to what we think will give us comfort or give us clarity, or what will give us guidance, or what will preserve us. When in distress, we go looking for some kind of peace. And that's what he's doing. He's out to find peace in his moment. And his peace he seeks is premised on a single idea. And it's this one. The first 18 verses are there to confirm that peace. And that peace is premised upon this truth, that God is there. Not so transcendent to be aloof, not so involved in all things to be unaware of the smallest thing. God is there. He is at hand. Or as we like to say around here, he's present. But present there in what sense? In a few senses, actually. This psalmist is teaching us that God is there in the fact that he knows everything and sees the whole playing field. You know when I sit down, when I rise up, you discern my thoughts from afar, it says in verse 2. It's the experience, isn't it, in long-standing friendships, that two people will begin to anticipate one another's moves and interpret their nuances with great, great sophistication, and even tailor their responses that fit the uniqueness of their friend in almost uncanny ways. Don't we know that experience already with people that we know very well? That kind of understanding of one another can be both unnerving, but also very consoling. And the psalmist is ascribing to God that very experience, but in a far supreme and unparalleled way. As Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, God knows what you need before you ask him. And in that, there is a great peace. God is there in that sense. He's also there in the sense that verse 7 speaks about when he says, where shall I go from your spirit? Where shall I flee from your presence? The psalmist is saying, there is no circumstance that I might encounter that is inaccessible to God. Which is in some ways an intimation of that paradox I mentioned at the introduction. The psalmist has a sense that God is everywhere, which could be both comforting and unsettling. When Adam and Eve repudiate the wisdom of God in Genesis 3, they find themselves trying to hide, but failing at the effort. When Jonah, when he thinks he can run, he does, only to discover that it's impossible to hide. When Paul says to Timothy in one of his letters, he says, "The sins of some people are conspicuous, going before them to judgment, but the sins of others appear later." He's saying, nothing is unknown. Nothing is forgotten. It might feel a little bit what this 34-year-old business manager who runs a big networking site through LinkedIn experienced this week. She gets a letter or an email from a 20-something who's asking that that 20-something might be brought into her network of managerial professionals. She's just asking for connection to this network. I mean, you know, the person can deny that or accept her into that network. But how the 34-year-old responds was nothing short of scathing and nasty, using words like, "You have such an entitlement situation, entitlement problem, you 20-somethings. You think everybody just sort of comes at your beck and call." And she just writes this really nasty and lengthy missive back to the 20-year-old, and within hours, that email goes everywhere. Viral, as they say. What was a very private word becomes expansively public. Millions of people read this woman's words. She can't flee. She can't hide. And so perhaps the psalmist is in some ways extolling that since God is everywhere, that can be a consolation, but it also might be a pretty good deterrent. Because nothing's hidden. Everything's laid bare. If you can't flee, why do anything that would make you want to think that you could? And so he's finding a peace, if you will, in God's thoroughgoing knowledge, but also in God's access to any and all circumstances. But thirdly, he's finding his peace in this, that there is no part of himself, no part of you, to which God is not privy. "You formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. My frame wasn't hidden from you." The psalmist is making this very bold proclamation that there is no peculiarity of any of us that he's not unaware of. No dimension of our particular story that he is unfamiliar with. He saw us coming, and he goes before us. He is, as Isaiah puts it, he declares the end from the beginning, from ancient times, things not yet done. In all those ways, the psalmist means to take heart in the midst of his distress, take heart in the fact that God is there, and he is absolutely bedazzled by that thought. "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me," he says in verse 6. "How precious to me are your thoughts of those, O God. How vast the sum of them," he says in verse 17. This sense that God is there is not just a factoid. It's a living sense. It's an amazed and an awed sense. But brothers and sisters, you hear all that, and I hear all that, and as soon as we begin to get a slightest sense of ecstasy to know that we are fully known by him, don't we immediately, if not reflexively, begin to ask ourselves about all those moments, past, present, and future, when it seemed that God's presence has proven more elusive? What about suffering? What of the choices, either that we have made or others that have made, that have led to nothing short of calamity? If God knows all, sees all, and is privy to all, then why all these ostensibly pointless and sometimes monstrous pains that come our way? Oh, we could devote the rest of the next 2 hours to talking about that question. I don't have that kind of time. But the question can be rightly asked, and it's pretty normal. And you find it in scads, in spades, throughout the Psalms and throughout the Bible itself. But while I might sound like something of a broken record, because I'm about to say something that I've kind of said similarly in the last few weeks, I'll say this. While it's reasonable to ask the why question. The inferences that may be implicit within that question may also rightly be questioned. What do I mean? To ask why there is pain in your life is a normal question, and a fruitful question sometimes. But to insinuate by the question that given my suffering, that means there can be no God, or at least not a God worth trusting, that is an assertion that is open to question. For the assertion is implying that no good God would ever have any good reasons for allowing these awful outcomes. Is that an assertion or an implication worth questioning? Absolutely. As much as asking the question, why this moment, O Lord? Because what accounts for a story like Horatio Spafford? He says goodbye to his family on a voyage across the Atlantic, his wife and his four children. That voyage meets disaster, and all the children drown, and the wife only makes it, and she survives and gets to the other side of the pond and sends a two-word telegram back to her husband saying only this, saved, alone. And then Horatio gets on another boat and takes that same voyage and takes the same route where his children have perished, and in the midst of that voyage composes one of the most enduring hymns of our day, "It Is Well With My Soul." What accounts for that kind of confidence in his presence? What accounts for the kind of confidence of something like C.S. Lewis in his own pilgrimage through his voyage through suffering that he details in a book like A Grief Observed, where he himself was unequivocally inquisitive about why God had done what he did? He offers no shortage of angry and disconsolate phrases to God, but then by the end of his book, he speaks of how suffering has transformed him. And he says, images of the holy easily become holy images. My idea of God is not a divine idea. It has to be shattered time after time. He shatters it himself. He is the great iconoclast. Could we not almost say that this shattering is one of the marks of his presence? What is to account for either man's confidence in the presence of God while it's as if his entire world has crumbled before his eyes? Could it be that the peace of God is real, not contrived, and that it comes to us at times like the hand that holds our hand when we're going into surgery? We don't know what the outcome will be. But there's something real and really comforting by another's presence. Do these stories answer the objection that God explains our specific pain? No. But they do keep you from allowing whatever your pain is to simply explain God away. And if you needed any more confirmation of that fact, you just have to remember the setting of the psalm. The psalmist is not walking on the beach. He is, to borrow a phrase, into the breach once more. He's in the middle of it, in the thick of it. And his reverie of God's presence is not in spite of his difficulty, but actually in the presence of difficulty. Until we know as we're fully known, we seek his peace. What else? Brothers and sisters, I don't know what you're facing right now, but to seek his peace is nothing more than to know that he is out in front. He knows you through and through. He knows what you're contending with. He knows every part of you, everything that has shaped you, every disposition with which you war. And he is still present. And that is a peace we seek. And that is why we're learning to pray these psalms. Because does not praying that psalm back to him in some way help us to face those issues differently? We seek his peace. But secondly, we also sift our passions. An intense internal celebration shifts abruptly into an equally intense passion against external forces that are hostile to God. The passion is expressed in a desire for deliverance, but it's coupled to nothing short of revulsion for those that are not just opposing him, but are opposing his God. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O men of blood, depart from me. I hate them with complete hatred. Okay. What do you do with words like that? He's not exactly equivocating here. And this surely is not the only place in the Psalms where you find words like that. What do you do? As one commentator put it, look, this is a prayer. It's not a program for human action. In other words, these words are genuinely descriptive of the psalmist's heart, but they are not patently prescriptive for all human hearts. But again, you can't just explain these away and ignore them. They're in the text. In one chapter in his Reflections on the Psalm, C.S. Lewis also admits that at one level, when it comes to all the cursings you find in the Psalms, there's something almost humorous about it for their naivete, he says. It's like, you know, maybe God never thought about ever vanquishing the wicked. Would God not have thought about that until they'd actually said, hey, would you vanquish the wicked? Lewis finds that somewhat amusing. But then Lewis will admit that while these words can neither be ignored or uncritically embraced, they can instruct. The passions in these words must be sifted. Sifted for what is the gold in them, for there is gold there. So how do they instruct? Lewis says they warn. They can warn us about what nursing angers can do, how they can breed a contempt in us that almost takes on a life of itself and leads you to act or think in ways that you never dreamt were possible. There was an article written by W.H. Auden, the English poet, that came out this week, and during World War II, he wrote a poem called The Cave of Making, and he wrote in that poem, "More than ever, life out there is goodly, miraculous, lovable, but we shan't, not since Stalin and Hitler, trust ourselves ever again. We know that subjectively all is possible." As Solzhenitsyn said it, darkness is shot through every human heart, and until you're aware of that, you are at risk of falling into the same trap that all men are afraid of. The psalmist's words demand that we sift our passions for where our angers, where they really come from. They warn us also about the secondary harm that we do to somebody else that we've harmed. It's one thing to offend somebody or hurt them, but it's another thing that now, as a consequence of your harm to them, now they are tempted to let their anger do in them what your anger could do in you. These words warn of that. But then Lewis noticed something rather intriguing. These passions, they instruct us not just by making us wary of them, but asking ourselves if they're even remotely present in us. And I mean by that a story that he tells during World War II. He listened to some soldiers banter among themselves, and among them, they had concluded that the British government was lying to them about the alleged atrocities that were being committed by the Germans. These soldiers were thinking that the government, their own government, was just using that as propaganda to motivate them to fight. Lewis wasn't scandalized by their belief in what the government might be doing, even though that belief was found to be very untrue. He was scandalized that these men believed that, but didn't seem to care. They expressed not the slightest indignation that a government would lie about the actions of others to motivate some men to kill other men. They just took that as, a cynicism. And in that moment, Lewis said he would rather take these threatening words from the psalmist or even a child's tantrum over that kind of dispassionate indifference to an utterly reprehensible thing. Beloved, there is plenty of vehemence for self and for power that is masquerading as righteous or even holy indignation, but there is also a cool detachment to things that is just as immoral as violence. And therefore, we have to sift our emotions. If you're not angry about something that's precious to you that another person is violating, you lose a certain measure of sympathy. Until we know as we've been fully known, we have to seek His peace and we have to sift our emotions. But finally, you have to do one more thing, the psalmist says. We have to submit to His probing. Submit to God's probing. As soon as the psalmist is done with vilifying his oppressors, he kind of moves into this very pensive tone. Maybe he's reflecting upon his own vehemence that he's just articulated. Maybe it's a more general contemplation. It's not clear. But the confidence he's already expressed in God's thoroughgoing knowledge of him leads him to ask God to illumine him further. In order to know the truth of his own heart, "Search me, O God, know my heart, try me, know my thoughts, see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." In these two verses, he is asking for two things: truth and grace. The truth about what's really beneath the surface. That grievous way that he's asking about is really, he's asking to be apprised of whatever might be idolatrous in him, whatever will not endure in him, whatever he has become insensible to. And he's asking to be apprised of what is so deep in him that it will not endure and therefore ought to be left behind. Sometimes it is only misfortunate circumstances that can create a context for some real insight. In the Gulag Archipelago, Solzhenitsyn writes of his own experience in the Gulag for decades, and he says, "Bless you, prison. Bless you for being in my life. For there, lying upon the rotting prison straw, I came to realize that the object of life is not prosperity, as we are made to believe, but maturity of the human soul." The psalmist is asking for truth. But in asking God to show him the way that does endure, the way that is ancient and eternal, he's also asking God for grace. Now, why grace? What God brings to light of the psalmist's heart may very well be truth of the most terrifying sort. Terrifying for what it reveals about the character of the psalmist's heart. And therefore, given what might be found in God's search of the psalmist's heart, the only thing that might keep God from turning himself away and having warrant and rationale for it is grace. The psalmist wants the truth, lest his version of the truth lead him astray. But the psalmist also needs the grace, lest the painful truths about his heart, lest it only condemn. Truth and grace. They are what submitting to the probing of God seeks. But brothers and sisters, they also represent the only way to resolve the paradox of being known. We need to be told the truth. To live in a lie is not to live. We need the truth that it sometimes will terrify us about the frightening things that we're capable of. And yet we also require a love, a grace that will liberate us from the fear of being known. Brothers and sisters, Jesus Christ is that truth and He is that grace. He always told the truth. And He did not flinch to tell us the deepest truth about our God and about ourselves, that our deepest need is rivaled only by His deeper love. That in God there is a paradox, that His wrath is sure and righteous, but that His love is able to turn it back in His own right. Jesus is the one who set this table and who goes to His cross to fulfill its intention. And therefore, Jesus Christ is the only way that you and I will ever move from the fear of being known to the freedom of being known. It's by trusting in the one who knows us so well and dies for us anyway that we shall ever leave the fear behind and walk in freedom. That is a truth that will carry us until we know as we have been known. Let me conclude with one more contribution from C.S. Lewis. At the end of the very last novel that he wrote, called Till We Have Faces, it is a retelling of the Greek myth of Cupid and Psyche. The main character in his retelling is named Arul. She was a king's daughter, homely, lacking in grace and elegance. But at the end of her book, at the end of the book, she has written a grievance to the gods. She writes an antagonistic complaint to them for all that she suffered and for taking away what she most loved. And she begins that letter in anger. But as she writes, her despising the gods turns to being humbled before them. Something is revealed in the course of the writing. And so on the front of your bulletin, I have her quote. "The change which the writing wrought in me was only a beginning, only to prepare me for the God's surgery. They used my own pen to probe my wound." She comes to realize their wisdom, but only by giving full concentration to her complaint. Her writing was her prayer. It was her improvisational praying. Brothers and sisters, as we finish this series and we come to this table, I'm asking you to commit yourself to sit with the last two verses of this text. Submitting to his probing by asking God the truth about your own heart, what you love most and what you hate most, what you secretly yearn for, and what you do your best to put forth publicly, which isn't true. Some of you will make that inquiry without consternation, but others of you will come like Arul did. However you might come, though, come. Ask for truth, even truth that might terrify, and then ask for the truth of his grace that it might be just as deeply discerned. Let's pray.
Search me, O Lord, know thou my heart. See if there be an impure way in me, lead me in thy way, lead me in thy way. Search me, O Lord, know thou my heart. See if there be an impure way in me, lead me in thy way, lead me